We'll not begin with your little note. Get into bed. She threw at me a very naughty look, so naughty that I would not kiss her good night at first. I covered her up and shut her door, in great displeasure. But repenting halfway, I returned softly, and lo, there was Miss standing at the table with a bit of blank paper before her and a pencil in her hand, which she guiltily slipped out of sight on my entrance. "You'll get nobody to take that, Catherine," I said, "if you write it, and at present I shall put out your candle." I set the extinguisher on the flame, receiving as I did so a slap on my hand and a petulant cross thing. I then quitted her again, and she drew the bolt, in one of her worst, most peevish humours. The letter was finished and forwarded to its destination by a milk fetcher who came from the village, but that I didn't learn till some time afterwards. Weeks passed on, and Cathy recovered her temper, though she grew wondrous fond of stealing off to corners by herself, and often. If I came near her suddenly while reading, she would start and bend over the book, evidently desirous to hide it, and I detected edges of loose paper sticking out beyond the leaves. She also got a trick of coming down early in the morning and lingering about the kitchen, as if she were expecting the arrival of something. And she had a small drawer in a cabinet in the library, which she would trifle over for hours, and whose key she took special care to remove when she left it. One day, as she inspected this drawer, I observed that the playthings and trinkets which recently formed its contents were transmuted into bits of folded paper. My curiosity and suspicions were roused. I determined to take a peep at her mysterious treasures. So at night, as soon as she and my master were safe upstairs, I searched, and readily found among my house keys one that would fit the lock. Having opened, I emptied the whole contents into my apron and took them with me to examine at leisure in my own chamber. Though I could not but suspect, I was still surprised to discover that they were a mass of correspondence, daily almost it must have been, from Linton Heathcliff, answers to documents forwarded by her. The earlier dated were embarrassed and short. Gradually, however, they expanded into copious love letters, foolish, as the age of the writer rendered natural, yet with touches here and there which I thought were borrowed from a more experienced source. Some of them struck me as singularly odd compounds of ardour and flatness. Commencing in strong feeling and concluding in the affected wordy style that a schoolboy might use to a fancied incorporeal sweetheart. Whether they satisfied Cathy, I don't know, but they appeared very worthless trash to me. After turning over as many as I thought proper, I tied them in a handkerchief and set them aside, relocking the vacant drawer. Following her habit, my young lady descended early and visited the kitchen. I watched her go to the door on the arrival of a certain little boy, and while the dairymaid filled his can, she tucked something into his jacket pocket and plucked something out. I went round by the garden and laid wait for the messenger, who fought valorously to defend his trust, and we spilt the milk between us. But I succeeded in abstracting the epistle, and threatening serious consequences if he did not look sharp home, I remained under the wall and perused Miss Cathy's affectionate composition. It was more simple and more eloquent than her cousin's, very pretty and very silly. I shook my head and went meditating into the house. The day being wet, she could not divert herself with rambling about the park, so, at the conclusion of her morning studies, she resorted to the solace of the drawer. Her father sat reading at the table, and I, on purpose, had sought a bit of work in some unripped fringes of the window curtain, keeping my eye steadily fixed on her proceedings. Never did any bird flying back to a plundered nest which it had left brimful of chirping young ones, express more complete despair in its anguished cries and flutterings than she by her single,
"Oh!"
and the change that transfigured her late happy countenance. Mr. Linton looked up. "What is the matter, love? Have you hurt yourself?" he said. His tone and look assured her he had not been the discoverer of the hoard.
"No, Papa,"
she gasped.
"Ellen? Ellen, come upstairs. I'm sick."
I obeyed her summons and accompanied her out,
Oh, Ellen, you have got them.
She commenced immediately, dropping on her knees when we were enclosed alone.
Oh, give them to me, and I'll never, never do so again. Don't tell Papa. You have not told Papa, Ellen. Say you have not. I've been exceedingly naughty, but I won't do it any more.
With a grave severity in my manner, I bade her stand up. So, I exclaimed, Miss Catherine, you are tolerably far on, it seems. You may well be ashamed of them. A fine bundle of trash you study in your leisure hours, to be sure. Why, it's good enough to be printed. And what do you suppose the master will think when I display it before him? I haven't shown it yet, but you needn't imagine I shall keep your ridiculous secrets. For shame. And you must have led the way in writing such absurdities. He would not have thought of beginning, I'm certain.
I didn't. I didn't,
sobbed Cathy, fit to break her heart.
I didn't once think of loving him till...
Loving, cried I, as scornfully as I could utter the word. Loving! Did anybody ever hear the like? I might just as well talk of loving the miller who comes once a year to buy our corn. Pretty loving, indeed. And both times together you have seen Linton hardly 4 hours in your life. Now here is the babyish trash. I'm going with it to the library, and we'll see what your father says to such loving. She sprang at her precious epistles, but I hold them above my head, and then she poured out further frantic entreaties that I would burn them, do anything rather than show them. And being really fully as much inclined to laugh as scold, for I esteemed it all girlish vanity, I at length relented in a measure and asked, If I consent to burn them, will you promise, faithfully, neither to send nor receive a letter again, nor a book, for I perceive you have sent him books, nor locks of hair, nor rings, nor playthings?
We don't send playthings,
cried Catherine, her pride overcoming her shame. Nor anything at all, then, my lady, I said. Unless you will, here I go.
I promise, Ellen,
she cried, catching my dress.
Oh, put them in the fire, do, do.
But when I proceeded to open a place with the poker, the sacrifice was too painful to be borne. She earnestly supplicated that I would spare her one or two.
One or two, Ellen, for Linton's sake.
I unknotted the handkerchief and commenced dropping them in from an angle, and the flame curled up the chimney.
I will have one, you cruel wretch!
She screamed, darting her hand into the fire and drawing forth some half-consumed fragments at the expense of her fingers. Very well, and I will have some to exhibit Papa, I answered, shaking back the rest into the bundle and turning anew to the door. She emptied her blackened pieces into the flames and motioned me to finish the immolation. It was done. I stirred up the ashes and interred them under a shovel full of coals, and she mutely, and with a sense of intense injury, retired to her private apartment. I descended to tell my master that the young lady's qualm of sickness was almost gone, but I judged it best for her to lie down a while. She wouldn't dine, but she reappeared at tea, pale and red about the eyes, and marvellously subdued in outward aspect. Next morning I answered the letter by a slip of paper inscribed, Master Heathcliff is requested to send no more notes to Miss Linton, as she will not receive them. And henceforth the little boy came with vacant pockets. Chapter 22 Summer drew to an end, and early autumn. It was past Michaelmas, but the harvest was late that year, and a few of our fields were still uncleared. Mr. Linton and his daughter would frequently walk out among the reapers. At the carrying of the last sheaves they stayed till dusk, and the evening happening to be chill and damp, my master caught a bad cold that settled obstinately on his lungs and confined him indoors throughout the whole of the winter, nearly without intermission. Poor Cathy, frightened from her little romance, had been considerably sadder and duller since its abandonment, and her father insisted on her reading less and taking more exercise. She had his companionship no longer. I esteemed it a duty to supply its lack as much as possible with mine. an insufficient substitute, for I could only spare 2 or 3 hours from my numerous diurnal occupations to follow her footsteps, and then my society was obviously less desirable than his. On an afternoon in October, or the beginning of November, a fresh watery afternoon when the turf and paths were rustling with moist withered leaves and the cold blue sky was half hidden by clouds, dark greyish streamers, rapidly mounting from the west and boding abundant rain, I requested my young lady to forego her ramble, because I was certain of showers. She refused, and I unwillingly donned a cloak and took my umbrella to accompany her on a stroll to the bottom of the park. A formal walk, which she generally affected if low-spirited, and that she invariably was when Mr. Edgar had been worse than ordinary, a thing never known from his confession, but guessed both by her and me from his increased silence and the melancholy of his countenance. She went sadly on. There was no running or bounding now, though the chill and wind might well have tempted her to race, and often from the side of my eye I could detect her raising a hand and brushing something off her cheek. I gazed round for a means of diverting her thoughts. On one side of the road rose a high, rough bank, where hazels and stunted oaks with their roots half exposed held uncertain tenure. The soil was too loose for the latter, and strong winds had blown some nearly horizontal. In summer, Miss Catherine delighted to climb along these trunks and sit in the branches, swinging 20 feet above the ground, and I, pleased with her agility and her light, childish heart, still considered it proper to scold every time I caught her at such an elevation. But so that she knew there was no necessity for descending. From dinner to tea, she would lie in her breeze-rocked cradle, doing nothing except singing old songs, my nursery lore, to herself, or watching the birds, joint tenants, feed and entice their young ones to fly, or nestling with closed lids, half-thinking, half-dreaming, happier than words can express.
"Look, miss,"
I exclaimed, pointing to a nook under the roots of one twisted tree. "Winter is not here yet. There's a little flower up yonder, the last bud from the multitude of bluebells that clouded those turf steps in July with a lilac mist. Will you clamber up and pluck it to show Papa?" Cathy stared a long time at the lonely blossom trembling in its earthly shelter, and replied at length, "No, I'll not touch it. But it looks melancholy, does it not, Ellen?" "Yes," I observed. "About as starved and suckless as you, your cheeks are bloodless. Let us take hold of hands and run. You're so low, I dare say I shall keep up with you."
"No,"
she repeated and continued sauntering on, pausing at intervals to muse over a bit of moss or a tuft of blanched grass or a fungus spreading its bright orange among the heaps of brown foliage. And ever and anon, her hand was lifted to her averted face.
"Catherine, why are you crying, love?"
I asked, approaching and putting my arm over her shoulder.
"You mustn't cry because Papa has a cold. Be thankful it is nothing worse."
She now put no further restraint on her tears. Her breath was stifled by sobs.
"Oh, it will be something worse,"
she said.
"And what shall I do when Papa and you leave me, and I am by myself? I can't forget your words, Ellen. They are always in my ear. How life will be changed. How dreary the world will be when Papa and you are dead."
"None can tell whether you won't die before us," I replied. "It's wrong to anticipate evil. We'll hope there are years and years to come before any of us go. Master is young, and I am strong, and hardly 45. My mother lived till 80, a canty dame to the last. And suppose Mr. Linton were spared till he saw 60. That would be more years than you have counted, miss. And would it not be foolish to mourn a calamity above 20 years beforehand?"
"But Aunt Isabella was younger than Papa,"
she remarked, gazing up with timid hope to seek further consolation. "Aunt Isabella had not you and me to nurse her," I replied. "She wasn't as happy as Master. She hadn't as much to live for. All you need do is to wait well on your father, and cheer him by letting him see you cheerful. and avoid giving him anxiety on any subject. Mind that, Kathy. I'll not disguise, but you might kill him if you were wild and reckless and cherished a foolish, fanciful affection for the son of a person who would be glad to have him in his grave, and allowed him to discover that you fretted over the separation he has judged it expedient to make.
I fret about nothing on earth except Papa's illness,
answered my companion.
I care for nothing in comparison with Papa, and I'll never, never, oh, never, while I have my senses, do an act or say a word to vex him. I love him better than myself, Ellen, and I know it by this. I pray every night that I may live after him, because I would rather be miserable than that he should be. That proves I love him better than myself.
Good words, I replied, but deeds must prove it also. And after he is well, remember you don't forget resolutions formed in the hour of fear. As we talked, we neared a door that opened onto the road, and my young lady, lightening into sunshine again, climbed up and seated herself on top of the wall, reaching over to gather some hips that bloomed scarlet on the summit branches of the wild rose trees shadowing the highway side. The lower fruit had disappeared, but only burrs could touch the upper, except from Kathy's present station. In stretching to pull them, her hat fell off, and as the door was locked, she proposed scrambling down to recover it. I bid her be cautious, lest she got a fall, and she nimbly disappeared, but the return was no such easy matter. The stones were smooth and neatly cemented, and the rose bushes and blackberry stragglers could yield no assistance in reascending. I, like a fool, didn't recollect that, till I heard her laughing and exclaiming,
"Ellen, you'll have to fetch the key, or else I must run round to the porter's lodge. I can't scale the ramparts on this side."
"Stay where you are," I answered. "I have my bundle of keys in my pocket. Perhaps I may manage to open it. If not, I'll go." Catherine amused herself with dancing to and fro before the door, while I tried all the large keys in succession. I had applied the last and found that none would do. So, repeating my desire that she would remain there, I was about to hurry home as fast as I could, when an approaching sound arrested me. It was the trot of a horse. Kathy's dance stopped also.
"Who is that?" I whispered. "Ellen, I wish you could open the door," whispered back my companion anxiously.
"Ah, Miss Linton," cried a deep voice, the rider's. "I'm glad to meet you. Don't be in haste to enter, for I have an explanation to ask and obtain."
"I shan't speak to you, Mr. Heathcliff," answered Catherine. "Papa says you are a wicked man and you hate both him and me, and Ellen says the same."
"That is nothing to the purpose," said Heathcliff. He it was. "I don't hate my son, I suppose, and it is concerning him that I demand your attention." "Yes, you have cause to blush. 2 or 3 months since, were you not in the habit of writing to Linton, making love in play, eh? You deserved both of you flogging for that. You especially, the elder and less sensitive as it turns out. I've got your letters, and if you give me any pertness, I'll send them to your father. I presume you grew weary of the amusement and dropped it, didn't you? Well, you dropped Linton with it into a slough of despond. He was in earnest. In love, really. As true as I live, he's dying for you, breaking his heart at your fickleness. Not figuratively, but actually. Though Hareton has made him a standing jest for 6 weeks, and I have used more serious measures and attempted to fright him out of his idiocy, he gets worse daily, and he'll be under the sod before summer, unless you restore him."
"How can you lie so glaringly to the poor child?" I called from the inside. "Pray ride on. How can you deliberately set up such paltry falsehoods? Miss Cathy, I'll knock the lock off with a stone. You won't believe that vile nonsense. You can feel in yourself it is impossible that a person should die for love of a stranger."
"I was not aware they were eavesdroppers," muttered the detective villain. "Worthy Mrs. Dean, I like you, but I don't like your double dealing," he added aloud. "How could you lie so glaringly as to affirm I hated the poor child, and invent bugbear stories to terrify her from my doorstones? Catherine Linton, the very name warms me, my bonny lass. I shall be from home all this week. Go and see if I have not spoken truth. Do, there's a darling. Just imagine your father in my place and Linton in yours. Then think how you would value your careless lover if he refused to stir a step to comfort you, when your father himself entreated him. And don't, from pure stupidity, fall into the same error. I swear on my salvation, he's going to his grave, and none but you can save him. The lock gave way, and I issued out. I swear Linton is dying, repeated Heathcliff, looking hard at me. And grief and disappointment are hastening his death. Nelly, if you won't let her go, you can walk over yourself. But I shall not return till this time next week, and I think your master himself would scarcely object to her visiting her cousin. Come in, said I, taking Cathy by the arm and half-forcing her to re-enter, for she lingered, viewing with troubled eyes the features of the speaker, too stern to express his inward deceit. He pushed his horse close and, bending down, observed, Miss Catherine, I'll own to you that I have little patience with Linton, and Hareton and Joseph have less. I'll own that he's with a harsh set. He pines for kindness as well as love, and a kind word from you would be his best medicine. Don't mind Mrs. Dean's cruel cautions, but be generous and contrive to see him. He dreams of you day and night, and cannot be persuaded that you don't hate him, since you neither write nor call. I closed the door and rolled a stone to assist the loosened lock in holding it, and spreading my umbrella, I drew my charge underneath, for the rain began to drive through the moaning branches of the trees and warned us to avoid delay. Our hurry prevented any comment on the encounter with Heathcliff as we stretched towards home, but I divined instinctively that Catherine's heart was clouded now in double darkness. Her features were so sad. They did not seem hers. She evidently regarded what she had heard as every syllable true. The master had retired to rest before we came in. Cathy stole to his room to inquire how he was. He had fallen asleep. She returned and asked me to sit with her in the library. We took our tea together, and afterwards she lay down on the rug and told me not to talk, for she was weary. I got a book and pretended to read. As soon as she supposed me absorbed in my occupation, she recommenced her silent weeping. It appeared at present her favourite diversion. I suffered her to enjoy it a while, then I expostulated, deriding and ridiculing all Mr. Heathcliff's assertions about his son, as if I were certain she would coincide. Alas, I hadn't skill to counteract the effect his account had produced. It was just what he intended.
You may be right, Ellen, she answered, but I shall never feel at ease till I know, and I must tell Linton it is not my fault that I don't write, and convince him that I shall not change.
What use were anger and protestations against her silly credulity? We parted that night, hostile, but next day beheld me on the road to Wuthering Heights, by the side of my wilful young mistress's pony. I couldn't bear to witness her sorrow, to see her pale, dejected countenance, and heavy eyes, and I yielded, in the faint hope that Linton himself might prove, by his reception of us, how little of the tale was founded on fact. Chapter 23 The rainy night had ushered in a misty morning, half frost, half drizzle, and temporary brooks crossed our path, gurgling from the uplands. My feet were thoroughly wetted. I was cross and low, exactly the humour suited for making the most of these disagreeable things. We entered the farmhouse by the kitchen way to ascertain whether Mr. Heathcliff were really absent, because I put slight faith in his own affirmation. Joseph seemed sitting in a sort of elysium alone, beside a roaring fire, a quart of ale on the table near him, bristling with large pieces of toasted oat cake, and his black short pipe in his mouth. Catherine ran to the hearth to warm herself. I asked if the master was in. My question remained so long unanswered that I thought the old man had grown deaf and repeated it louder.
"Nay," he snarled, or rather screamed through his nose. "Nay, you mun go back where you come from."
"Joseph!"
cried a peevish voice simultaneously with me from the inner room.
How often am I to call you? There are only a few red ashes now. Joseph, come this moment!
Vigorous puffs and a resolute stare into the grate declared he had no ear for this appeal. The housekeeper and Hareton were invisible, one gone on an errand and the other at his work, probably. We knew Linton's tones and entered.
Oh, I hope you'll die in a garret, starved to death,
said the boy, mistaking our approach for that of his negligent attendant. He stopped on observing his error. His cousin flew to him.
Is that you, Miss Linton?
He said, raising his head from the arm of the great chair in which he reclined.
No, don't kiss me. It takes my breath. Dear me, Papa said you would call,
continued he after recovering a little from Catherine's embrace, while she stood by looking very contrite.
Will you shut the door, if you please? You left it open. And those detestable creatures won't bring coals to the fire. It's so cold.
I stirred up the cinders and fetched a scuttleful myself. The invalid complained of being covered with ashes, but he had a tiresome cough and looked feverish and ill, so I did not rebuke his temper.
Well, Linton,
murmured Catherine when his corrugated brow relaxed.
Are you glad to see me? Can I do you any good?
Why didn't you come before?
He asked.
You should have come instead of writing. It tired me dreadfully writing those long letters. I'd far rather have talked to you. Now I can neither bear to talk nor anything else. I wonder where Zilla is. Will you,
looking at me,
step into the kitchen and see?
I had received no thanks for my other service, and being unwilling to run to and fro at his behest, I replied,
Nobody is out there but Joseph. I want to drink,
he exclaimed, fretfully turning away.
Zilla is constantly gadding off to Gimmerton since Papa went. It's miserable. And I'm obliged to come down here. They resolved never to hear me upstairs.
Is your father attentive to you, Master Heathcliff? I asked, perceiving Catherine to be checked in her friendly advances.
Attentive? He makes them a little more attentive at least,
he cried.
The wretches! Do you know, Miss Linton, that brute Hareton laughs at me? I hate him, indeed. I hate them all. They are odious beings.
Cathy began searching for some water. She lighted on a pitcher in the dresser, filled a tumbler, and brought it. He bid her add a spoonful of wine from a bottle on the table, and having swallowed a small portion, appeared more tranquil, and said she was very kind.
And are you glad to see me?
Asked she, reiterating her former question, and pleased to detect the faint dawn of a smile.
Yes, I am. It's something new to hear a voice like yours,
he replied.
But I have been vexed because you wouldn't come, and Papa swore it was owing to me. He called me a pitiful, shuffling, worthless thing, and said you despised me, and if he had been in my place, he would be more the master of the Grange than your father by this time.
But you don't despise me, do you, miss?
I wish you would say Catherine or Cathy, interrupted my young lady.
Despise you? No. Next to Papa and Ellen, I love you better than anybody living. I don't love Mr. Heathcliff, though, and I dare not come when he returns. Will he stay away many days?
Not many, answered Linton, but he goes on the moors frequently, since the shooting season commenced, and you might spend an hour or two with me in his absence. Do say you will. I think I should not be peevish with you. You'd not provoke me, and you'd always be ready to help me, wouldn't you?
Yes, said Catherine,
stroking his long soft hair. If I could only get Papa's consent, I'd spend half my time with you, pretty Linton. I wish you were my brother.
And then you would like me as well as your father,
observed he, more cheerfully.
But Papa says you would love me better than him and all the world if you were my wife, so I'd rather you were that.
No, I should never love anybody better than Papa,
she returned gravely.
And people hate their wives sometimes, but not their sisters and brothers. And if you were the latter, you would live with us, and Papa would be as fond of you as he is of me.
Linton denied that people ever hated their wives, but Cathy affirmed they did, and in her wisdom, instanced his own father's aversion to her aunt. I endeavoured to stop her thoughtless tongue. I couldn't succeed till everything she knew was out. Master Heathcliff, much irritated, asserted her relation was false.
"Papa told me, and Papa does not tell falsehoods," she answered pertly.
"My papa scorns yours," cried Linton. "He calls him a sneaking fool."
"Yours is a wicked man," retorted Catherine, "and you are very naughty to dare to repeat what he says. He must be wicked to have made Aunt Isabella leave him as she did."
"She didn't leave him," said the boy. "You shan't contradict me."
"She did,"
cried my young lady.
"Well, I'll tell you something," said Linton. "Your mother hated your father. Now then."
"Oh,"
exclaimed Catherine, too enraged to continue.
"And she loved mine," added he.
"You little liar. I hate you now,"
she panted, and her face grew red with passion.
"She did, she did,"
sang Linton, sinking into the recess of his chair and leaning back his head to enjoy the agitation of the other disputant, who stood behind.
"Hush, Master Heathcliff," I said. "That's your father's tale too, I suppose." "It isn't. You hold your tongue," he answered. "She did, she did, Catherine, she did, she did."
Cathy, beside herself, gave the chair a violent push and caused him to fall against one arm. He was immediately seized by a suffocating cough that soon ended his triumph. It lasted so long that it frightened even me. As to his cousin, she wept with all her might, aghast at the mischief she had done, though she said nothing. I held him till the fit exhausted itself. Then he thrust me away and leant his head down silently. Catherine quelled her lamentations also, took a seat opposite, and looked solemnly into the fire. "How do you feel now, Master Heathcliff?" I inquired after waiting 10 minutes.
"I wish she felt as I do," he replied. "Spiteful, cruel thing! Hareton never touches me. He never struck me in his life. And I was better today, and there..."
His voice died in a whimper.
"I didn't strike you,"
muttered Cathy, chewing her lip to prevent another burst of emotion. He sighed and moaned like one under great suffering, and kept it up for a quarter of an hour, on purpose to distress his cousin, apparently, for whenever he caught a stifled sob from her, he put renewed pain and pathos into the inflections of his voice.
"I'm sorry I hurt you, Linton,"
she said at length, racked beyond endurance.
"But I couldn't have been hurt by that little push, and I had no idea that you could either. You're not much, are you, Linton? Don't let me go home thinking I've done you harm. Answer, speak to me."
"I can't speak to you," he murmured. "You've hurt me so that I shall lie awake all night, choking with this cough. If you had it, you'd know what it was. But you'll be comfortably asleep while I'm in agony, and nobody near me. I wonder how you would like to pass those fearful nights."
And he began to wail aloud for very pity of himself. "Since you are in the habit of passing dreadful nights," I said, "it won't be Miss who spoils your ease. You'd be the same had she never come. However, she shall not disturb you again, and perhaps you'll get quieter when we leave you."
"Must I go?"
asked Catherine dolefully, bending over him.
"Do you want me to go, Linton?"
"You can't alter what you've done,"
he replied pettishly, shrinking from her.
"Unless you alter it for the worse by teasing me into a fever."
"Well, then I must go," she repeated.
"Let me alone, at least," said he. "I can't bear your talking."
She lingered and resisted my persuasions to depart a tiresome while, but as he neither looked up nor spoke, she finally made a movement to the door and I followed. We were recalled by a scream. Linton had slid from his seat onto the hearthstone and lay writhing in the mere perverseness of an indulged plague of a child, determined to be as grievous and harassing as it can. I thoroughly gauged his disposition from his behaviour,
and saw at once it would be folly to attempt humouring him. Not so my companion. She ran back in terror, knelt down, and cried and soothed and entreated, till he grew quiet from lack of breath, by no means from compunction at distressing her. "I shall lift him onto the settle," I said, "and he may roll about as he pleases. We can't stop to watch him. I hope you are satisfied, Miss Cathy, that you are not the person to benefit him, and that his condition of health is not occasioned by attachment to you. Now then, there he is. Come away. As soon as he knows there is nobody by to care for his nonsense, he'll be glad to lie still." She placed a cushion under his head and offered him some water. He rejected the latter and tossed uneasily on the former, as if it were a stone or a block of wood. She tried to put it more comfortably.
"I can't do with that," he said. "It's not high enough."
Catherine brought another to lay above it.
"That's too high,"
murmured the provoking thing.
"How must I arrange it, then?"
she asked despairingly. He twined himself up to her as she half knelt by the settle, and converted her shoulder into a support. "No, that won't do," I said. "You'll be content with the cushion, Master Heathcliff. Miss has wasted too much time on you already. We cannot remain 5 minutes longer."
"Yes, yes, we can," replied Cathy. "He's good and patient now. He's beginning to think I shall have far greater misery than he will tonight, if I believe he is the worse for my visit, and then I dare not come again. Tell the truth about it, Linton, for I mustn't come if I have hurt you." "You must come to cure me," he answered. "You ought to come because you have hurt me. You know you have extremely. I was not as ill when you entered as I am at present, was I?" "But you've made yourself ill by crying and being in a passion. I didn't do it all," said his cousin. "However, we'll be friends now. And you want me. You would wish to see me sometimes, really."
"I told you I did," he replied impatiently. "Sit on the settle and let me lean on your knee. That's as Mama used to do, whole afternoons together. Sit quite still and don't talk. But you may sing a song, if you can sing, or you may say a nice long interesting ballad, one of those you promised to teach me, or a story. I'd rather have a ballad, though. Begin."
Catherine repeated the longest she could remember. The employment pleased both mightily. Linton would have another, and after that another, notwithstanding my strenuous objections, and so they went on until the clock struck 12, and we heard Hareton in the court returning for his dinner.
"And tomorrow, Catherine, will you be here tomorrow?"
asked young Heathcliff, holding her frock as she rose reluctantly. "No," I answered, "nor next day neither." She, however, gave a different response evidently, for his forehead cleared as she stooped and whispered in his ear.
"You won't go tomorrow, recollect, miss,"
I commenced when we were out of the house.
"You are not dreaming of it, are you?"
She smiled. "Oh, I'll take good care," I continued. "I'll have that lock mended and you can escape by no way else."
"I can get over the wall," she said, laughing. "The Grange is not a prison, Ellen, and you are not my jailer. And besides, I'm almost 17, I'm a woman, and I'm certain Linton would recover quickly if he had me to look after him. I'm older than he is, you know, and wiser, less childish. Am I not? And he'll soon do as I direct him, with some slight coaxing. He's a pretty little darling when he's good. I'd make such a pet of him if he were mine. We should never quarrel, should we, after we were used to each other? Don't you like him, Ellen?"
"Like him?" I exclaimed. "The worst-tempered bit of sickly slip that ever struggled into its teens. Happily, as Mr. Heathcliff conjectured, he'll not win 20. I doubt whether he'll see spring indeed. And small loss to his family whenever he drops off. And lucky it is for us that his father took him. The kinder he was treated, the more tedious and selfish he'd be. I'm glad you have no chance of having him for a husband, Miss Catherine."
My companion waxed serious at hearing this speech. To speak of his death so regardlessly wounded her feelings.
He's younger than I,
she answered after a protracted pause of meditation.
And he ought to live the longest. He will, he must live as long as I do. He's as strong now as when he first came into the North. I'm positive of that. It's only a cold that ails him, the same as Papa has. You say Papa will get better, and why shouldn't he?
Well, well, I cried. After all, we needn't trouble ourselves, for listen, miss, and mind, I'll keep my word. If you attempt going to Wuthering Heights again, with or without me, I shall inform Mr. Linton, and unless he allow it, the intimacy with your cousin must not be revived.
It has been revived, muttered Cathy sulkily. Must not be continued, then, I said.
We'll see, was her reply, and she set off at a gallop, leaving me to toil in the rear. We both reached home before our dinner time. My master supposed we had been wandering through the park, and therefore he demanded no explanation of our absence. As soon as I entered, I hastened to change my soaked shoes and stockings, but sitting such a while at the Heights had done the mischief. On the succeeding morning I was laid up, and during 3 weeks I remained incapacitated for attending to my duties, a calamity never experienced prior to that period, and never, I am thankful to say, since. My little mistress behaved like an angel in coming to wait on me, and cheer my solitude. The confinement brought me exceedingly low. It is wearisome to a stirring, active body, but few have slighter reasons for complaint than I had. The moment Catherine left Mr. Linton's room, she appeared at my bedside. Her day was divided between us. No amusement usurped a minute. She neglected her meals, her studies, and her play, and she was the fondest nurse that ever watched. She must have had a warm heart when she loved her father so to give so much to me. I said her days were divided between us, but the master retired early, and I generally needed nothing after 6 o'clock, thus the evening was her own. Poor thing. I never considered what she did with herself after tea. And though frequently when she looked in to bid me good night, I remarked a fresh colour in her cheeks and pinkness over her slender fingers. Instead of fancying the line borrowed from a cold ride across the moors, I laid it to the charge of a hot fire in the library.
Chapter 24. At the close of 3 weeks, I was able to quit my chamber and move about the house, and on the first occasion of my sitting up in the evening, I asked Catherine to read to me, because my eyes were weak. We were in the library, the master having gone to bed. She consented, rather unwillingly, I fancied, and imagining my sort of books did not suit her, I bid her please herself in the choice of what she perused. She selected one of her own favourites, and got forward steadily, about an hour. Then came frequent questions.
Ellen, are you not tired? Hadn't you better lie down now? You'll be sick keeping up so long, Ellen.
No, no, dear, I'm not tired, I returned continually.
Perceiving me immovable, she essayed another method of showing her disrelish for her occupation. It changed to yawning and stretching, and,
Ellen, I'm tired.
Give over then and talk, I answered. That was worse. She fretted and sighed and looked at her watch till 8 and finally went to her room, completely overdone with sleep, judging by her peevish, heavy look and the constant rubbing she inflicted on her eyes. The following night she seemed more impatient still, and on the 3rd, from recovering my company, she complained of a headache and left me. I thought her conduct odd, and having remained alone a long while, I resolved on going and inquiring whether she were better, and asking her to come and lie on the sofa instead of upstairs in the dark. No Catherine could I discover upstairs, and none below. The servants affirmed they had not seen her. I listened at Mr. Edgar's door. All was silence. I returned to her apartment, extinguished my candle, and seated myself in the window. The moon shone bright, a sprinkling of snow covered the ground, and I reflected that she might possibly have taken it into her head to walk about the garden for refreshment. I did detect a figure creeping along the inner fence of the park, but it was not my young mistress.
On its emerging into the light, I recognised one of the grooms. He stood a considerable period, viewing the carriage road through the grounds, then started off at a brisk pace, as if he had detected something, and reappeared presently, leading Mrs. Pony, and there she was, just dismounted and walking by its side. The man took his charge stealthily across the grass towards the stable. Cathy entered by the casement window of the drawing-room, and glided noiselessly up to where I awaited her. She put the door gently to, slipped off her snowy shoes, untied her hat, and was proceeding, unconscious of my espionage, to lay aside her mantle, when I suddenly rose and revealed myself. The surprise petrified her an instant. She uttered an inarticulate exclamation and stood fixed. "My dear Miss Catherine," I began, too vividly impressed by her recent kindness to break into a scold. "Where have you been riding out at this hour? And why should you try to deceive me by telling a tale? Where have you been? Speak." "To the bottom of the park," she stammered. "I didn't tell a tale." "And nowhere else?" I demanded.
"No,"
was the muttered reply.
"Oh, Catherine,"
I cried sorrowfully. "You know you have been doing wrong, or you wouldn't be driven to uttering an untruth to me. That does grieve me. I'd rather be 3 months ill than hear you frame a deliberate lie." She sprang forward and, bursting into tears, threw her arms around my neck.
"Well, Ellen, I'm so afraid of you being angry,"
she said.
"Promise not to be angry and you shall know the very truth. I hate to hide it."
We sat down in the window seat. I assured her I would not scold, whatever her secret might be, and I guessed it, of course. So she commenced. "I've been to Wuthering Heights, Ellen, and I've never missed going a day since you fell ill, except thrice before, and twice after you left your room. I gave Michael books and pictures to prepare Minnie every evening, and to put her back in the stable. You mustn't scold him either, mind. I was at the Heights by 6:30, and generally stayed till 8:30, and then galloped home. It was not to amuse myself that I went. I was often wretched all the time. Now and then I was happy. Once in a week, perhaps. At first I expected there would be sad work persuading you to let me keep my word to Linton, for I had engaged to call again the next day when we quitted him. But as you stayed upstairs on the morrow, I escaped that trouble. While Michael was refastening the lock of the park door in the afternoon, I got possession of the key and told him how my cousin wished me to visit him, because he was sick and couldn't come to the Grange, and how Papa would object to my going. And then I negotiated with him about the pony. He is fond of reading, and he thinks of leaving soon to get married, so he offered, if I would lend him books out of the library, to do what I wished. But I preferred giving him my own, and that satisfied him better. On my second visit, Linton seemed in lively spirits, and Zillah, that is her housekeeper, made us a clean room and a good fire, and told us that, as Joseph was out at a prayer meeting and Hareton Earnshaw was off with his dogs, robbing our woods of pheasants, as I heard afterwards, we might do what we liked. She brought me some warm wine and gingerbread and appeared exceedingly good-natured, and Linton sat in the armchair, and I in the little rocking-chair on the hearthstone, and we laughed and talked so merrily, and found so much to say. We planned where we would go and what we would do in summer. I needn't repeat that, because you would call it silly. One time, however, we were near quarrelling. He said the pleasantest manner of spending a hot July day was lying from morning till evening on a bank of heath in the middle of the moors, with the bees humming dreamily about among the bloom, and the larks singing high up overhead, and the blue sky and bright sun shining steadily and cloudlessly. That was his most perfect idea of heaven's happiness. Mine was rocking in a rustling green tree, with a west wind blowing, and bright white clouds flitting rapidly above, and not only larks, but throstles and blackbirds and linnets and cuckoos pouring out music on every side, and the moors seen at a distance, broken into cool dusky dells, but close by great swells of long grass undulating in waves to the breeze, and woods and sounding water, and the whole world awake and wild with joy. He wanted all to lie in an ecstasy of peace. I wanted all to sparkle and dance in a glorious jubilee. I said his heaven would be only half alive, and he said mine would be drunk. I said I should fall asleep in his, and he said he could not breathe in mine, and began to grow very snappish. At last we agreed to try both, as soon as the right weather came, and we kissed each other and were friends. After sitting still an hour, I looked at the great room with its smooth, uncarpeted floor, and thought how nice it would be to play in, if we removed the table, and I asked Linton to call Zilla in to help us, and we'd have a game at Blind Man's Buff. She should try to catch us. You used to, you know, Ellen. He wouldn't. There was no pleasure in it, he said. But he consented to play at ball with me. We found two in a cupboard, among a heap of old toys, tops and hoops, and battledores and shuttlecocks. One was marked C, and the other H. I wished to have the C because that stood for Catherine, and the H might be for Heathcliff, his name. But the bran came out of H, and Linton didn't like it. I beat him constantly, and he got cross again, and coughed and returned to his chair. That night, though, he easily recovered his good humour. He was charmed with two or three pretty songs, your songs, Ellen, and when I was obliged to go, he begged and entreated me to come the following evening, and I promised. Minnie and I went flying home as light as air, and I dreamt of Wuthering Heights and my sweet darling cousin till morning. On the morrow I was sad, partly because you were poorly and partly that I wished my father knew and approved of my excursions. But it was beautiful moonlight after tea, and as I rode on the gloom cleared. I shall have another happy evening, I thought to myself, and what delights me more, my pretty Linton will. I trotted up their garden and was turning round to the back, when that fellow Earnshaw let me in, took my bridle and bid me go in by the front entrance. He patted Minnie's neck and said she was a bonny beast and appeared as if he wanted me to speak to him. I only told him to leave my horse alone or else it would kick him. He answered in his vulgar accent,
"It wouldn't do much hurt if it did,"
and surveyed its legs with a smile. I was half inclined to make it try. However, he moved off to open the door, and as he raised the latch, he looked up to the inscription above, and said, with a stupid mixture of awkwardness and elation,
"Miss Catherine, I can read yon now."
"Wonderful," I exclaimed. "Pray let us hear you. You are grown clever." He spelt and drawled over by syllables the name Hareton Earnshaw.
"And the figures?"
I cried encouragingly, perceiving that he came to a dead halt.
"I cannot tell them yet," he answered.
"Oh, you dunce," I said, laughing heartily at his failure. The fool stared with a grin hovering about his lips, and a scowl gathering over his eyes, as if uncertain whether he might not join in my mirth, whether it were not pleasant familiarity, or what it really was, contempt. I settled his doubts by suddenly retrieving my gravity, and desiring him to walk away, for I came to see Linton, not him. He reddened, I saw that by the moonlight, dropped his hand from the latch and skulked off a picture of mortified vanity. He imagined himself to be as accomplished as Linton, I suppose, because he could spell his own name, and was marvellously discomfited that I didn't think the same.
"Stop, Miss Catherine, dear," I interrupted. "I shall not scold, but I don't like your conduct there. If you had remembered that Hareton was your cousin as much as Master Heathcliff, you would have felt how improper it was to behave in that way. At least it was praiseworthy ambition for him to desire to be as accomplished as Linton, and probably he did not learn merely to show off. You had made him ashamed of his ignorance before, I have no doubt, and he wished to remedy it and please you. To sneer at his imperfect attempt was very bad breeding. Had you been brought up in his circumstances, would you be less rude? He was as quick and as intelligent a child as ever you were."
and I'm hurt that he should be despised now, because that base Heathcliff has treated him so unjustly.
Well, Ellen, you won't cry about it, will you?
She exclaimed, surprised at my earnestness.
But wait, and you shall hear if he conned his ABC to please me, and if it were worthwhile being civil to the brute.
I entered. Linton was lying on the settle, and half got up to welcome me.
I'm ill tonight, Catherine, love, he said, and you must have all the talk and let me listen. Come and sit by me. I was sure you wouldn't break your word, and I'll make you promise again before you go.
I knew now that I mustn't tease him as he was ill, and I spoke softly and put no questions and avoided irritating him in any way. I had brought some of my nicest books for him. He asked me to read a little of one, and I was about to comply when Earnshaw burst the door open, having gathered venom with reflection. He advanced direct to us, seized Linton by the arm, and swung him off the seat.
"Get to thy own room,"
he said, in a voice almost inarticulate with passion, and his face looked swelled and furious.
"Take her there if she comes to see thee. Thou shalt keep me out of this. Begone with your birth."
He swore at us, and left Linton no time to answer, nearly throwing him into the kitchen. And he clenched his fist as I followed, seemingly longing to knock me down. I was afraid for a moment, and I let one volume fall. He kicked it after me and shut us out. I heard a malignant crackly laugh by the fire, and turning beheld that odious Joseph standing rubbing his bony hands and quivering.
"I was sure he'd serve ye out. He's a grand lad. He's getting right spirit in him. He knows, aye, he knows as well as I do, who should be master yonder. He made ye skit properly."
"Where must we go?" I asked of my cousin, disregarding the old wretch's mockery. Linton was white and trembling. He was not pretty then, Ellen. Oh, no. He looked frightful, for his thin face and large eyes were wrought into an expression of frantic, powerless fury. He grasped the handle of the door and shook it. It was fastened inside.
"If you don't let me in, I'll kill you! If you don't let me in, I'll kill you!"
he rather shrieked than said.
"Devil, devil, I'll kill you, I'll kill you!"
Joseph uttered his croaking laugh again.
"There, that's it, father," he cried. "That's father, we've all a summit at either side in us. Never heed Ayrton, lad. Dunna be feared, he cannot get at thee."
I took hold of Linton's hands and tried to pull him away, but he shrieked so shockingly that I dared not proceed. At last his cries were choked by a dreadful fit of coughing. Blood gushed from his mouth, and he fell on the ground. I ran into the yard, sick with terror, and called for Zillah as loud as I could. She soon heard me. She was milking the cows in a shed behind the barn, and hurrying from her work, she inquired what there was to do. I hadn't breath to explain, dragging her in. I looked about for Linton. Earnshaw had come out to examine the mischief he had caused, and he was then conveying the poor thing upstairs. Zillah and I ascended after him, but he stopped me at the top of the steps and said I shouldn't go in. I must go home. I exclaimed that he had killed Linton, and I would enter. Joseph locked the door and declared I should do
no such stuff,
and asked me whether I were
bound to be as mad as him.
I stood crying till the housekeeper reappeared. She affirmed he would be better in a bit, but he couldn't do with that shrieking and din, and she took me and nearly carried me into the house. Ellen, I was ready to tear my hair off my head. I sobbed and wept so that my eyes were almost blind, and the ruffian you have such sympathy with stood opposite, presuming every now and then to bid me whist, and denying that it was his fault, and finally, frightened by my assertions that I would tell Papa and that he should be put in prison and hanged, he commenced blubbering himself and hurried out to hide his cowardly agitation. Still, I was not rid of him.
When at length they had compelled me to depart and I had got some 100 yards off the premises, he suddenly issued from the shadow of the roadside and checked Minnie and took hold of me.
"Miss Catherine, I am ill-grieved,"
he began,
"but it's rather too bad."
I gave him a cut with my whip, thinking perhaps he would murder me. He let go, thundering one of his horrid curses, and I galloped home more than half out of my senses. I didn't bid you good night that evening, and I didn't go to Wuthering Heights the next. I wished to go exceedingly, but I was strangely excited, and dreaded to hear that Linton was dead sometimes, and sometimes shuddered at the thought of encountering Hareton. On the third day, I took courage. At least I couldn't bear longer suspense, and stole off once more. I went at 5 o'clock and walked, fancying I might manage to creep into the house and up to Linton's room unobserved. However, the dogs gave notice of my approach. Zillah received me, and saying, "The lad was mending nicely," showed me into a small, tidy, carpeted apartment, where, to my inexpressible joy, I beheld Linton, laid on a little sofa, reading one of my books. But he would neither speak to me nor look at me. Through a whole hour, Ellen, he has such an unhappy temper. And what quite confounded me, when he did open his mouth, it was to utter the falsehood that I had occasioned the uproar, and Hareton was not to blame. Unable to reply except passionately, I got up and walked from the room. He sent after me a faint, "Catherine!" He did not reckon on being answered, so. But I wouldn't turn back. And the morrow was the second day on which I stayed at home, nearly determined to visit him no more. But it was so miserable going to bed and getting up and never hearing anything about him, that my resolution melted into air before it was properly formed. It had appeared wrong to take the journey once. Now it seemed wrong to refrain. Michael came to ask if he must saddle Minnie. I said yes and considered myself doing a duty as she bore me over the hills. I was forced to pass the front windows to get to the court. It was no use trying to conceal my presence.
"Young master is in the house," said Zillah, as she saw me making for the parlour.
I went in. Earnshaw was there also, but he quitted the room directly. Linton sat in the great armchair half asleep. Walking up to the fire, I began in a serious tone, partly meaning it to be true.
"As you don't like me, Linton, and as you think I come on purpose to hurt you, and pretend that I do so every time, this is our last meeting.